little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan. Welcome to a show called Thinking Clearly, and we are a show about critical thinking and related topics. My name is Bob Frelick.
I am Julia Minton.
And I want to remind you that this show has ways that our listeners can contact us. So welcome to the show. We have a special guest on the line with us tonight, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. But first, Julia is going to tell everyone how to get in contact with us, because we love to hear from you.
Yeah, Bob and I are real people, and we love to hear from you, our listeners. You have given us so many good ideas for shows, and we appreciate the feedback. So you can contact us. We have a Facebook page, Thinking Clearly Radio. If you type that in your search bar, it'll pop right up. And we respond to that. You can message us there, or leave comments, follow us for future promos. And we are also podcasting. Welcome to the future, Thinking Clearly podcast. So if you just open up your favorite podcast app, you search Thinking Clearly, we should come right up, and you should be able to subscribe and get all our shows. Or visit us on the website.
At thinkingclearly.libsyn.com.
That's right.
And just a review, a real quick review, we have a rather lengthy description of what critical thinking is, at least the way we conceive it on this show. I'm going to get into the very brief core part of that description.
Give us the Cliff Notes version, Bob.
This is even briefer than the Cliff Notes, yeah. Because we have 4 points that we talk about in our description of critical thinking, and we usually reiterate that every show. It's on our Facebook page. But just for people who have just tuned in or maybe don't know much about what critical thinking really is, the core issue in critical thinking is that critical thinking is a mode of thinking that uses the process of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of a robust cross-section of evidence relevant to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and beliefs. So it's evidence-based logical thinking. There's a number of other points that are part of that description that really form the scope of this show, because we don't just talk about deductive reasoning and inductive reasoning and fallacies and things like that.
Although we have talked about those
things. Yes, we have, but it's not limited to that, because our definition, our scope, our description, our vision of critical thinking goes way beyond that. And so we talk about related topics to that core idea of critical thinking. The topic for this episode tonight is going to relate to teaching, learning, and practicing critical thinking. Mm-hmm. And we have a special guest. His name is Richard Parker. He's professor emeritus of philosophy at Cal State University, Chico. And Richard is also a co-author, along with his friend and colleague at Chico State, Brooke Moore, of my favorite book on critical thinking. Now, I haven't seen every book on critical thinking, but of the books that I've seen on critical thinking, this is my favorite.
You wouldn't even give it back to me.
I wouldn't. And we'll tell you the story of that in just a second. But I also want to let you know that Richard's publications include the areas of analytic philosophy, philosophy of law, as well as critical thinking. And outside of academia, he's distinguished himself as a proficient flamenco guitarist. And so I looked up flamenco guitars. Not that I didn't know what that is, but, you know, it didn't come back with what I thought it would, because I spelled it as flamingo guitarist. But it caught my ear.
I know, but I'm going to be Googling later.
Okay. I had to tell that story just to let people know how fallible I am. But before we get started, Richard, I want to welcome you to Thinking Clearly.
Welcome, Richard.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Julia. It's a pleasure to be here.
And before we get started with the discussion, I want to remind those listening that to this live version of Thinking Clearly, broadcast on KMUD, that we're going to open the phone lines. That'll take place around 7:45 or so for questions for our guest and the topic that we're talking about. And we will give the telephone number to call when that happens. I want to start off, Richard, by asking about your book. because I've got the fourth edition of that book. Now, the little story about that book and how I got that book is that that book was previously owned by Julia.
That is true.
And she brought that in one day, and I started looking at that book. And
this book came from my my favorite textbooks that I actually am enough of a nerd that I kept my favorite textbooks. And when I was going through the boxes, I found it and I went, oh, Bob's going to like this one.
Yeah. And I liked it so much that I borrowed it from her.
I
did borrow it. I really did borrow it. And I read the whole thing. I loved it. And then I hesitantly, returned it to her. And I think she kind of maybe saw that hesitancy in my way that I was returning that.
You mean the arm wrestle that took place?
Yeah. And she said, would you like that book? And I said, I'd love that book. And so, you know, Julia and I have this thing. We agree about a lot of things, but we disagree about some things. And one of the things that we disagree about is that when I own a book, I annotate that book. I mark it up, I write in it, I fold the pages.
And this was my college textbook.
I know.
This got me through a semester.
And it was pristine.
It was absolutely, you needed gloves to handle it.
Yeah, exactly. And it was pristine. And it wasn't, it was in not exactly the same, there was a little dog earring on the cover and stuff when I gave it back to her, but I didn't write in it.
20 years of storage.
I don't write in a book that's someone else's. But now when she gave this book to me, I'm rereading the whole thing so that I can annotate it. That's a big, long story about how we got
that's
the book,
why I
Richard.
Knew you needed it. You needed to mark it up. So.
Okay.
So thank you, Richard. Thank you so much for this this jewel we have.
Yeah. And I've got the fourth edition, and you're up to the 12th edition now. And my question
maybe I can help.
Okay.
You'll send me a mailing address. Send the two of you a copy. I think I have a spare copy of the 12th edition.
Oh, my goodness.
That's wonderful.
The edition you have is, I'm guessing, about 20 years old.
It's, yes.
I really enjoyed I was just flipping through it today, and the flashbacks, there's references to Rodney King, and there was a lovely portion about, it was from the late 90s, and I have a much richer history with philosophy than Bob does. He's just
I'm impoverished with philosophy.
He's a newbie to philosophy, so I'm really glad that this could assist him in his philosophic journey.
Will there be a 13th edition? That was I was pondering.
The 13th edition, we have been told by McGraw-Hill that the 13th edition, we're supposed to get our materials to McGraw-Hill this spring, and the 13th edition will be out sometime later this year. I'm not sure exactly when, but certainly by next winter.
Well, that's great.
They tend to come out. We do a new edition. Oh, it turns out approximately every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Since the first edition came out in 1986.
Well, that's wonderful because with all that's happened in the last few years and with the Oxford Dictionary naming post-truth as the word of the year back in 2016 and since the 2016 election, and there's been so much that happened, you will be at no loss for having relevant information and examples to use in that textbook.
As a matter of fact, we are overwhelmed with examples. I mean, there's the chapter, I can't remember if the fourth edition, I think they seem to run together after a while.
Don't worry, it's not a test.
I'm not sure if it had a chapter on credibility. I know we talked about it, but I don't know if it was a separate chapter like it is now.
I don't think so. And in fact, this edition didn't get almost at all into confirmation bias and biases and the cognitive psychology.
No, we didn't do cognitive biases until just a few editions ago. Those early editions didn't deal with it at all.
Right.
Actually, we dealt with some of the effects, but we didn't put it in terms of cognitive biases.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, like I said, I'll be happy to send you, if I can find one, I'm pretty sure I can, send you a copy of the 12th edition, and then you can sell that 4th edition. I was at Amazon a few days ago for, I don't remember what reason, but I was looking at critical thinking textbooks. There are a lot of them around these days. And there's a little blurb there that says rare, used in rare books. So I clicked on that, and my God, there are four different sellers there selling later editions than yours for over $600 a piece.
Are you kidding me?
Bob, I want my book back.
No, I'm not kidding. It was two for $600 and something and one for $700 and something. And these are editions that they printed zillions of copies of.
How do you feel about marketing it up now,
what?
Bob?
Yeah,
here's a test of non-critical thinking. Anybody who buys one of those books.
I will say, you know, some things, we were just kind of saying some things, you know, have changed a lot, and you can certainly find lots of examples, but some things haven't changed that much. I was flipping through again this, the fourth edition from over 20 years ago, and I love the breakdown of avoiding sexist language and how you get into, it's really about specificity and being clear in who you're talking about, and that, you know, it's...
Yes.
It's mankind, humankind, his was gender neutral as in our Constitution, but not so much anymore, and it's important to be specific.
Well, we thought it was important to get something in because there's something to just simply being kind and being respectful that sort of goes along with thinking critically, at least in my head anyhow. And so we included that business on sexist language and derogatory terminology for that kind of reason. Since that time, there's been, oh my word, so much go on in that department. This was before we got LGBT community that needs to be referred to properly. And I don't know. That's just a There was a whole lot of that stuff that we did. I don't know how many editions we carried it through, but you still find little hints of it here and there in the current editions.
I will take you up on that and give you a mailing address, and thank you very much for that. That'll be great. I have one other kind of slightly frivolous question about the book, and then we can move on. But that is that some people that do editions of books actually skip the 13th edition because 13 is an unlucky number. They actually skip over that. I'm assuming you're not going to do that on a book about critical thinking, though.
Well, I would be amazed and disappointed if they did. That's up to McGraw-Hill, what they call it. But no, this is not like the 13th floor of a hotel.
Okay. All right.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was, so I encountered this textbook while I was at a community college in Southern California. And I'm happy to see now, you know, critical thinking instruction is much more incorporated into not just the community college system, but also, you know, with Common Core, the California K-12
yeah.
system. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts about why, what would be the rationale for critical thinking requirements? But most of all, why is it important? Why has critical thinking become an important part of our standardized instruction?
Well, let me give you a little history, Julia. The impetus for critical thinking requirements began, really, with the trustees of the Cal State University system. They were working on a new general education program in, I believe, the late 70s. It had to be the late 70s because the culmination of that work turned into an executive memo. It's a notorious, it's famous, executive memo 338. That specified what the Cal State system must include in their general education program. And among other things, every CSU student was required to complete 3 units in critical thinking. Now, that Executive Memorandum 338 specified just what coverage was necessary in any course that's going to fulfill that requirement. They actually spelled it out fairly thoroughly. But concisely, thinking back about 40 years, I guess, I recall that, I don't know, they mentioned the distinction between facts and opinions, the distinction between inductive and deductive reasoning, and also on the list was coverage of typical fallacies of reasoning. And the idea, and this is more to the answer your question about why is it important to have these skills. But these skills are deemed to be foundational skills. They're the sort of intellectual abilities that every college graduate should have, and the trustees wanted them to be addressed directly rather than just given, a glancing blow while students are studying something else. As far as I know, this was the first large-scale implementation of critical thinking requirements in the United States. There may have been somewhere here or there, but this was the scale here was huge because the CSU system had then, and I'm sure has more now, a third of a million students. And then, since a large percentage of the community college students in California, and there are, I think, approximately a bazillion of those, a lot of those move on to the CSU system after a couple of years. So they, too, are going to be held to these general education requirements that were developed for the CSU.
Yeah, so the community college went through the same thing following suit, ways to meet that critical thinking A3 requirement.
Well, you can see suddenly there's a very large market just in California for course materials that covered everything that the CSU trustees wanted. And then along come Moore and Parker in critical thinking. And the timing was extremely fortunate for us. We'd been thinking about writing a book to use in what was then our Philosophy 2 class, but this memorandum from the trustees gave us a sort of a skeleton that we could flesh out with examples and explanations and such sort of thing we'd been using in our classes.
And your Philosophy and so, 2, anyhow, your Philosophy 2 is a formal logic class, is that right?
No, this was it was a basic logic class, and it covered about the same stuff, but not in quite the systematic fashion that we wound up doing it in the first edition of the book.
Well, my question is that some Cal States, the philosophy department never did introduce critical thinking because their logic class would meet the A3 breadth requirements in itself.
Yeah.
And so there must be a philosophical split in faculty as to whether they should introduce a separate class called critical thinking. Because I know still some schools don't. I think HSU, Humboldt State University, doesn't teach a critical thinking class out of philosophy. They teach one out of communications, one out of psychology, and a few other departments. But they still have the logic class, but no critical thinking class.
Yeah. Well, it was a madhouse, an academic madhouse, Bob, back when the general education program was being implemented, and there were turf wars on probably half or more than half of the Cal State campuses. In some places, for example, at Chico State, most students got the critical thinking requirement, the A3 part of general ed, satisfied in a course in the philosophy department. Because the philosophy department had been teaching logic since time immemorial, since Aristotle. And so we wound up in the philosophy department handling the great bulk of students, and to a great extent that's still true here at Chico State. But there are a couple of other courses in other departments on the campus that have, that satisfy that same A3 requirement, and on some campuses, I take it Humboldt State is one of them, where maybe the great bulk of students who satisfy the requirement do it outside the philosophy department and do it in psychology or education or wherever.
And a lot of them do it in the second English class because a lot of them have to take that anyway, so that meets an A3 requirement usually.
Yeah. You're right. That's true, and I've run across several places where that's done, and that's perfectly all right. Matter of fact, our book is used in several psychology department classes and several English department classes, not on our campus but other places, and so but that I think guarantees that they get the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons the trustees specifically identified some of these topics was so that they would be dealt with directly and on their own terms. In other words, you wouldn't get it while you were studying some topic in sociology and somebody mentioned begging the question, for example, or there's a false dilemma, or what have you. But it's more a matter of actually studying the fallacies themselves and using examples from other fields, maybe, but where you focus on the fallacies or on the type of reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that's clear.
Kind of a follow-up question, and I'm sure we'll get back sometime later to other reasons besides meeting a requirement why critical thinking is important. What is the difference between a logic class and critical thinking class?
You can't just draw a nice little neat line, because you can't do a critical thinking class without doing some logic.
Right.
I mean, there are some standard arguments that crop up in evaluating reasoning in general. For example, something like affirming the consequent. So we have an argument that if P is true, then Q is true. Well, Q is true, therefore P must be true. Now, that's an invalid argument, but it's invalid formally. And when you do a formal analysis of that argument, you get if P, then Q, Q, therefore P, and you can show using a truth table or any number of ways why that's an invalid argument. So the formal logic, at least at some very elementary level, enters into any kind of critical thinking class. And it would be really a mistake to simply pass over that.
And then just to clarify for our listeners, I think that you're using the term formal logic to mean it's not dressed up in a tuxedo or anything, but it's for the formal applies to the form.
Let me explain, right.
Yeah.
The form of an argument that makes it valid deductively in formal systems. And for example, what I said a moment ago, I said, if P, then Q. Q, therefore P. Now, I'm not giving an argument. I'm giving a form of an argument.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? In other words, what makes it formal is that it doesn't depend on the meanings of the terms in the claims. For example, P could be any claim whatsoever. Q could be any claim whatsoever. But that argument, if P then Q, Q therefore P, that's invalid. And on the other hand, a different version of it, if P then Q, P therefore Q, that's a perfectly valid argument. It's been around long enough to have a fancy Latin name, modus ponens. But that's what makes it a formal.
Mm-hmm.
What makes logic formal is that you're dealing with the form of the claims rather than the meanings of the terms in the claims. Here's an example of an argument that's a valid argument that's not formal. John is a bachelor, therefore John is unmarried. But that depends on the meanings of the terms married and bachelor, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly true, that if John is a bachelor, he is unmarried, because that's what bachelor means. But that's not formally valid, that argument. Am I being clear enough here?
Yeah, I just don't assume that as we're talking that the listeners all know the words when they can, especially when they can be used in different meanings. But yeah, that's clear. And so I guess what you're saying is that some understanding of the forms of arguments and the principles of logic is going to be common, whether the course is called critical thinking or whether it's called logic.
Exactly.
Would one distinction be that in a critical thinking class that you are more apt to be talking about real life issues that people are going to experience, and that might be one difference between that and a logic class, or am I wrong with that?
Certainly, any kind of advanced logic class, what you said is exactly right. I taught the advanced logic class here at Chico for many, many, many years. And there, it's really, you're dealing with formal systems that you can do very kinds of fancy proofs. As a matter of fact, my advanced logic class counted in our math department as a proof theory class, as we talked about the foundations of mathematics and set theory and a bunch of other stuff. But it goes way beyond the day of the business of everyday reasoning, everyday argumentation. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, critical thinking stays there. Critical thinking is designed to be connected with one's life to as great an extent as possible. But it can't get, you know, Monday till Tuesday without doing some level of critical thinking.
So that would be one of the things that I'm headed towards here, is that to make some recommendations for how listeners who are interested in going further with the topic of critical thinking, because they understand the importance of it, then they can, by listening to this show or doing it on the internet, but maybe want to take a class, that it would probably be better for them to seek out a class that has the course title Critical Thinking, rather than just a straight logic class. Is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, once upon a time, our course here was entitled Critical Thinking, Elementary Logic and Critical Thinking, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, elementary logic can mean just introduction to logic or maybe logic, or it can have a technical meaning as well. But here, it just meant basic logic, of just of the sort I was talking about a while ago.
Okay.
Incidentally, I mentioned we start this book off. We've been doing it now for quite a while. The very first page of the very first chapter, we tell a story about somebody who doesn't think critically and gets in trouble as a result. The current one has to do with a bank robber, and the next one, I just decided to write it up. I may do that tonight or tomorrow. Here's an example of another bank robber. I don't know what it is about bank robbers these days. Here's a guy who went to rob a bank, and he got caught because his image was captured on video cameras. What happened was he had learned, this is hard to believe, he had learned that lemon juice made a very good invisible ink. Now, if you wrote something in lemon juice and it dried, it was invisible. You held it over a candle and it shows up. So he painted his face with lemon juice, thinking that the camera, it would be invisible to the cameras. Well, he wasn't, and he's currently in jail. This guy's name is something Wheeler. I just read about him the other day. But that's the first chapter, first page of the first chapter of the new edition coming out. You can depend on it.
So it sounds like he was using some reasoning, but perhaps faulty reasoning.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Pay attention, kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. The word invisible is what confused him, I guess. That's great.
There's the thing. You know, he was trying to reason by analogy, I guess, but he was doing a bad job of that. Because if he thought the lemon juice was going to make his face disappear,
yeah,
when he rubbed it on the page, it should have made the piece of paper disappear, shouldn't it?
Exactly. Very good. Faulty reasoning by analogy. I just want to mention something, and I think Julia has a question for you. But if I'm making recommendations to our local listeners somewhere in Humboldt County or one of the adjoining counties that are getting our signal, that is the class I would recommend at College of the Redwoods is Philosophy 1, which is a critical thinking course taught by the philosophy department. I think they have a couple sections in their schedule open. And at Humboldt State University, if you want the more formal logic, it's Philosophy 100. There's also a Psych 100, which is Psychology of Critical Thinking. And there's a Communications 103, which is called Critical Listening and Thinking. We want to gear this program and our thinking towards making recommendations to folks who want to go on and get deeper into the subject.
We're all lifelong learners.
Yeah.
I just have to come in defense of logic here. Just because you didn't like the class you took, Bob, doesn't mean that they're not likable classes. The first community college class I ever took was a formal logic class. And that's exactly why I came back for more. I became a philosophy major and I took critical thinking. So I'm just saying, I know.
Well, you're my kind of lady, Julia.
We are officially critical thinking nerds over here. But I really I really enjoyed logic because it is a little bit more mathematical. It takes some of the bias, that emotion, and it makes an argument more mechanical. And to me, that was kind of a comfortable thing to do. Mm-hmm. And actually, I feel like it helped inform how I understood critical thinking that much better. But
well, I have to defend myself because I didn't really say that I didn't like the logic course.
I know that you didn't.
No, I did. I when I took logic, I was an undergraduate and I was a chemistry major, and it was the closest thing I could come to mathematics and science was a logic class. So that's why I took logic. But they didn't have critical thinking at the back in that day. But where my mind is going with the recommendations is that for folks that are listening to this program that are not going to be philosophy majors, but realize the importance of critical thinking, that a course usually that's got critical thinking in the title or course description is probably the course that you want to take.
We are a critical thinking show.
Yeah. No, that's quite right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The phrase critical thinking just didn't come along. For a long time, before our book ran to so many editions, the book that was out there, the widest book, the most widely adopted and went on for years, 13 editions at least, was Irving Coppi's Introduction to Logic. Hmm. And the phrase critical thinking simply wasn't current at the time. His book was first done sometime in the 50s, I think probably the earlier middle 50s. And because it was the first book that I used in a logic course or a critical thinking course, but it covered a lot of the same critical thinking stuff that we now think of as critical thinking, but it didn't use the phrase at all. It was called Introduction to Logic, and that's that.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see, I think I'll just add some more commentary. I think part of the reason, too, Bob really likes this is we look for exercises, ways to apply this to everyday experiences. And that can be a little bit more challenging with logic, whereas I just kind of randomly opened up the fourth edition here. And I love that we have two people featured as, you say, elevated horse laugh pseudo-reasoning to a high art. Pseudo-reasoning to a high art. We're talking about Ross Perot and Rush Limbaugh. So I just had to take a moment to enjoy that.
So we used to use that phrase pseudo reasoning through several editions, and that's stuff that looks like reasoning but isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it applies to most of what have always traditionally been called informal fallacies.
Mm-hmm.
Those fall under the general category of pseudo reasoning. Things that look like somebody's making an argument for something, but when it's really just nonsense.
Like your bank robber friend there.
I'm
really curious about your perspective as a philosophy professor who obviously has a strong interest in critical thinking. From your perspective as a teacher, what are the important aspects? What are the things that you really, the important stuff you hope people take away, and the things that you wish you could guide them in understanding critical thinking better in what you're trying to teach?
Oh, gee, well, that's a very large question, Julia.
Don't worry, we only have 25 minutes.
I guess as sort of an overall point, getting students to be careful, to pay close attention. That's one main goal of any critical thinking course, in my estimation. I mentioned credibility earlier. The importance of determining how much credibility a claim or a claim's source should receive is just impossible to overestimate. These days, this day and age, the air is just full of controversial claims coming from everywhere, from the television, from our politicians, from scientists and pseudoscientists, public health, climate, immigration, you name it, 100 things. It's really crucial to have a good sense of when to at least tentatively accept a claim and when to ignore it. And so just being careful and not giving credence to everything equally that you hear. In the book, we've constantly, for years, for many editions, we've talked about credibility in terms of whether a claim that somebody makes, a statement, whether it has credibility just on its own feet. And then we talk about the source. Where does that claim come from? Is that a credible source? And we are alive with incredible sources these days, aren't
we?
Yes. Yeah.
We're in the era of incredible sources and fake news. Yes, that 13th, I'm looking forward to looking at that 13th edition, too, on, you know, we can see a little, some glimpses of it on Amazon, on the look inside the book.
Yeah, incidentally, the 13th edition, I'm not sure, it might be an almost exclusively online edition. McGraw-Hill is going more and more that way, mm-hmm. so I don't know what the situation with the paper book will be. I heard that they're going to make paper books and they can rent them, but whether you can buy one or not, I just don't know. They don't tell us everything like that.
How am I going to mark up a book now?
you can't on Kindle.
I'm having a panic attack right
Adobe
now.
Adobe Acrobat Reader will allow you to.
I guess.
You can learn to do it that way.
I guess. Well, here's kind of a related question. What do students struggle most with in learning critical thinking?
You know, it's funny. Probably my students stumbled most probably in the two deductive logic chapters, the one on categorical logic and the one on truth functional logic. And the reason there, I guess, is because it's fairly cut and dried. Not entirely, but very largely. And it can get a little complicated. Now, the students tend to fall into two classes. The larger ones are the ones that struggle some with the formal logic. The smaller group are the ones who just love those two chapters. And they were the two favorite chapters in the textbook. And they were people who, well, for example, math majors tended to love those. Science majors, but not exclusively so. I mean, there was a young Japanese girl I'll never forget who was an English major, and she just killed the exams on those two chapters. I don't think she missed a point.
She probably went on to law school.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, what else do they struggle with? Well, I don't know. Reading complicated matters has, even modestly complicated matters, it seems to be trouble for more and more students. Toward the end of my teaching career, it was actually a discouragement, and I don't know why. There are all kinds of I hear people blame it on screens and smartphones and on television and on this, that, and the other thing, and I frankly just don't know.
Mm-hmm. So, but you did see a difference in students from when you very first started teaching the course to when you finally retired?
It seems to me that there was a difference, a student devolution, if you like. But you know, that's really a hard thing to back up.
Sure.
And it's just kind of a sense of things that I've got. I don't know, Bob. It's hard to say. I used to say that I shouldn't say this, but I will.
Nobody's listening. Go ahead.
Students, the last few semesters I taught were so busy, interested in other things besides their schoolwork, that it got to be discouraging, and that made it easier for me to retire. Remember, I used to say that when my interest in their education got down close to the level of their interest in their education, it was time for me to go. That's a little bit creepy, I know.
You put down the lecture and the books and took up the flamenco guitar, huh?
Well, yeah, actually, I've been sort of doing a bit of the flamenco guitar all along, but yes, it became way more important to me after I gave up the classroom. I thought that the classroom, that's the only part of my career that I really thought I would miss, and I do. But not as much as I thought I would.
Well, there you go.
But since that time, actually, I've done radio commentary. So I did 10 years of radio commentary on the public radio station here in Chico. And then for several years, it was carried on 20 public radio stations in California.
Oh, great.
On an outfit called CalNet that came out of Long Beach. Yeah, I still do one around here on the local North State Public Radio from time to time.
Well, fantastic. You do have a great, great radio voice, I can tell.
Oh, come now.
I am interested in education. Bob introduced me to this word, the transfer of learning question. That is, you know, how much learning from one context transfers to another context.
I was afraid you were going to remember to ask that. I wish I knew what.
Well, that's fair.
What the answer to that is, I don't think anybody knows exactly, because there hasn't been. I was for some years back, I was married to a wonderful lady who was also a professor of philosophy, and she retired at Cal State, Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, and she was big on assessment. She was, the system, I think, roped her into doing a big study of assessment, what students are actually learning, and I know it was a boondoggle. It was a really difficult thing to do. She sweated bullets over that business. But it's hard to know just what transfers, and it's, frankly, we're not in a position, as teachers of critical thinking, we're not in the best position to know.
Yeah.
We get a tiny little bit of anecdotal evidence. I have a student come back to me every now and then, had one just a few months ago, as a matter of fact, said, Dr. Parker, your class was so helpful to me. I've made use of it in my life here and there and in other classes and so forth and so on. And that's wonderful to hear. But I hear, over the years, I heard it occasionally out of the thousands and thousands of students that went through my classes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, it is anecdotal.
It's anecdotal evidence, but it gives me the idea that that's a good question maybe for a whole episode of future episode of Thinking Clearly to look into that research. I've looked into it a little bit. There are some classes that that's been tested on, and maybe we can get a guest actually talks about that.
I'm also kind of curious about some of this anecdotal information, because I am not a professor of philosophy, and I have not taught critical thinking. Is there anything that feedback, because I get that, it's hard to quantitatively know exactly what's happening out there, but of that sort of anecdotal feedback you have gotten from your students, do you recall anything that may have surprised you or, that you hadn't expected somebody to find that this sort of information was useful in that application?
Yes. Time to time. Well, one thing, I was a little bit surprised and pleased that several students would remember the names of the phalluses that we covered in the class. They could come back and tell you what a straw man argument was, what a false dilemma was, what it means to beg the question, which incidentally is not the way people use it anymore. Mm-hmm. These days, people use the phrase begging the question, or that begs the question, and they just mean that asks for the following question, or that begs for a question. Begging the question is a whole different matter in terms of critical thinking. At any rate, but those students did remember a lot of that, or at least I recall some. Who said yes? I ran across people to other faculty using what looked to me to be a fallacy straight out of the textbook. I thought, well, good for you.
Well, fallacies are fun, and people like to play the fallacy game and catch up the people that they're talking to on what fallacies they're using. Well, I want to remind folks that we are talking to Richard Parker. And he's an author and professor emeritus of philosophy from Cal State Chico. We're talking about learning and teaching and practicing critical thinking. And while we're waiting for some calls, let me ask you this. And we got into this a little bit, but one of the things that we've hit a lot on this show is cognitive psychology and the vulnerabilities that we all have. And I did, like I say, notice that. Do we have a caller, Eric? Oh, okay. Then we'll continue with the question in a moment, and let's take our first call. Welcome to Thinking Clearly, caller.
Well, we had someone call in, and they tuned in late, and they heard you talking about this great book, but they wanted to know the name of the book.
It's called? Critical thinking.
Oh, that's easy.
how clever. Huh?
By Moore and Parker. And the thing is, it's textbook. So if you get the most current edition, it's going to be fairly pricey. But you can always get a.
You never know. One of us might have one to loan. You never know. Yeah.
Well, I was. You know, when we were talking about he was talking about selling the fourth edition. I was saying, well, I would. I wouldn't do this if it was $600, but it's probably not $600. But
you can get one for $4, $3 or $4.
Yeah, exactly.
No, you're just bringing up a sore subject because I still owe someone a book from a pledge drive because I haven't had the chance to mark it up as they requested.
Okay, Critical Thinking by Parker and Moore.
Yeah, and again, we have about a little less than 10 more minutes. So if you have a question along this topic of critical thinking, the book Critical Thinking and Teaching and Learning.
Yeah.
Critical thinking.
And so I'm not going to get the question really had to do with the cognitive vulnerabilities and that kind of thing, but we've already sort of talked about that you have included a section of that in the 12th edition.
Yeah.
You said it went back to the 9th or something like that.
Yeah. Bob, I really do think that actually I give Brooke credit for he started us on down the road of covering the biases, the cognitive biases, and of those, I really do think that a couple are especially important. I think the confirmation bias is everywhere, and that's in case your listeners.
I agree with you.
That's when you give a lot more credence to claims that agree with what you already believe.
I agree with you, and I think you're right.
Yeah, and the other one is sort of an in-group, in-group thinking.
Yeah.
In other words, if you identify as a Democrat or a Republican, you automatically presume that what another Democrat or if you're a Republican, you give them more credence to what they say than what you would give to someone on the other side. We just seem to be built like that.
That definitely. That's a powerful one. And we will be talking about cultural cognition and identity protective cognition in a future show.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about tribalism quite a bit.
Yeah.
It's silly. I think, did you mention that in the note you sent to me about the knowledge illusion?
Right, knowledge illusion.
There's a whole lot of stuff. I mean, a whole lot of talk lately about the so-called knowledge illusion, or simply the business of people who are bad at something, but they're bad enough at it that they don't realize how bad they are at it.
Right, I know that's the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Yeah, that's the Dunning-Kruger
effect. Yeah, right, the Dunning-Kruger effect. Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's been around for quite a while. The knowledge illusion is that we don't know as much as we think we know, and that's been around.
Well, usually I
tie all those kind of together. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have another caller on the line, and welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
Yes. Since you brought it up, would you please define begging the question?
Okay. Go ahead, Richard.
That's it.
I'm sorry. Would you read the question?
The caller would like to, since we brought it up, like to hear you, if you don't mind, define begging the question, the fallacy.
Oh, sure. In a nutshell, it's when the thing, the claim you're trying to prove, you smuggle it into the premises. I told a story in a film. It was kind of a cornball story in one of the earlier editions. I think it's gone now, but something like this. Two guys are gold mining, and one of them finds a big nugget and says, "Whoa!" says this one's mine. He said to the other, "says Oh, wait a minute." Says, "Why do you get that nugget and not me?" And he says, "Well, because I'm the leader of this expedition." And he says, "Well, what makes you the leader?" He says, "Well, I got the gold and you don't."
That's begging the question.
The idea there is, of course, he's got the what Teddy Most is saying is, "I get the gold because I've got the gold."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The standard example of this has to do with Scripture. You know, I believe the Bible. Why? Well, because it was written by God, and And how do you know that? So what does it say so right here in the Bible?
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm curious for, and we're just down to our last few minutes. Doesn't look like we have any more callers at the moment, but I'm curious your perspective, especially because you did start writing this book with your partner, Brooke Moore, your co-author, over 30 years ago, and you and we've talked all throughout this show about how it's been upgraded. It's been new topics have been brought to the surface, chapters have been added as this topic expands and becomes more common knowledge. I'm really curious to hear your thoughts about where, if you had a crystal ball of critical thinking, where you see us going. What sort of information do you think you would behoove us to stay on top of and to be a part of our active learning?
Wow, you know how to lay it on a guy here.
Don't worry, we're down to our last 3 minutes.
Well, first of all, I don't have a crystal ball. I can make some guesses. I would put my money on more research into the psychology of belief and the psychology of reasoning, if you like. You know, Daniel Kahneman he's done some pretty interesting work. He's been at it for some years.
That's some of other Bob's favorite books.
Yeah, well, doesn't surprise me a bit, my dear. But that's what I would think. I would think we learn more and more about how we think. We learn more and more about neurology. The more we learn about how the brain works, the more we learn about how we think, the more we're going to understand both good reasoning and bad reasoning, I think, or I hope. That's not a very satisfying answer, Julia. I'm sorry, but it's the best I can do off the top of my head.
No, that's a great answer.
She has this very satisfied look on her face.
I couldn't have set that up better.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, that's a big part of where we've been going in this show. And the last thing I want to sort of get into, since we have a couple minutes left here, is if people are not able to take a class, I suggested some classes. If they're not able to take a class, but they want to go somewhat beyond what we talk on this about on this show, it's hard to really do any teaching over radio in a short time that we have.
Sure.
We introduce topics and try to pique people's interest. If they want to go beyond that, do you have any idea of resources that they might utilize?
Well, of course, what naturally comes to mind is they've gone and buy a copy of our book.
Exactly.
Then buy a used copy. I mean, get an older edition. If you want to go out and spend $100, you can get the current thing. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to do that. You can buy a used book. That doesn't do me and Moore any good, but that's all right. We never were in it entirely for the money to begin with. But yes, do that. And there are actually some websites. Do a Google on critical thinking and go to the Stanford. When you find topics, go to the Stanford Dictionary of Philosophy online. And if you just poke around on the web, you'll find some things. And let's see.
No, that is a really great resource. That is a really great resource. I definitely have visited the Stanford Dictionary of Philosophy many times. So if, for instance, you were looking for a definition of begging the question, that would be a fantastic place to go.
Yeah,
exactly.
You'd find everything you need there that pertains to philosophy. And we will eventually, and we have in the past, made some links to resources, and we'll continue to do that. Okay, well, we have been talking to Richard Parker, and Richard is an author of this book called Critical Thinking that you can find a used copy of not that much money.
And I have to say, when I was taking this class in the late 90s, I never thought that I would be sitting here interviewing one of the authors. So thank you, Richard.
We've been talking to Richard and enjoyed that very much. Thank you for your insights. And thank you, Eric Allen, for your fine and faithful engineering of our program.
Our favorite engineer for today.
And thank you both. It's been fun talking to you.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you very much, Richard Parker. And I'm Julia Minton with Bob Frelick. And we're signing off. Keep on thinking.
Clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People-Powered Radio.